down here already. It was going really fast, but then there was a tremendous... There was a tremendous traffic jam from that Chemish. I'm here, I'm going. We're up to Perek Chaf Zayin, chapter 27. And again, we'll have to be relatively selective, but the pasuk begins, Al tishalel biyom machar, do not praise yourself for what you think you will be able to do tomorrow. A person might say, well, you know, tomorrow I have wonderful chavrusas, a wonderful shir, I will accomplish so much. Because kilo seida, ma yeled yaim. You don't know what's going to happen today. Again, now, the Vilna Gaon, you know, in the Vilna Gaon's Perek, not in Mishnah only, but in Perkei Avos, that he brings, the Mishnah Perkei Avos, and he says the same thing in Perkei Avos. The Gra says, the Gra tries to find a makor in Torah Shebichsav for every teaching of Chazal in Pirkei Avos. And the Gra will draw not only on the Chamishei Chumshei Torah, he'll also draw on Nevi'im, Ksuvim, Mishlei. So you all know the famous teaching of Hillel, Al Tomar L'Chsheefne Eshne, do not say, when I have time, I will learn. Shema Lo Tipane, lest you will not have the time later. And therefore you have to take advantage of the time that you have now. And the Gra says that's exactly what this pasuk is saying. One should not look and assume that there will be great opportunities that will open up in the future. One needs to take advantage of the moment that they have now. Carpe diem, as they say in Latin, seize the moment. One has to be machshiv every second of life, because you don't know whether it's going to be the last. Now, truth of the matter is, like many issues in Mishlei, this is more complicated than it would seem. As a general rule, yeah, if you have the moment now. But the problem is that people often have situations in life, particularly about Aliyah and moving to Eretz Yisrael. Let's say a person says, for example, if I come to Eretz Yisrael now, you know, I don't have the money, I'm going to have to work the whole day, whatever, but if I can work another 2 years in Chutz La'aretz, B'derech HaTeva, you never know, I may have enough money that I could come here and spend the rest of my life, you know, in Kollel. Those are difficult situations. On one hand, you say, you know, you don't push off things you don't know. On the other hand, there may be a certain amount of hishtadlus that would be appropriate. But the overall message is a person has to take advantage of life. Now, maybe that's a simple message, but it's easier said than done. And if we contemplate the precious moments and opportunities, you know, I remember when I was in yeshiva, we used to have, you know, yeshiva, you know, it's Neri Israel, a regular, you know, yeshiva. But occasionally when you had alumni who would visit, they tended to be rich alumni, you know, and they would they would be given permission to address the student body. They weren't necessarily big ones on them, but you know, they would give a little bit of a shmooze, like we sometimes in our semech. Some guys come and you know they just give you a talk of chizuk and the like. So the guys always gave the shmooze about yeshiva, the best years of your life, you know, take advantage of it, because once you get out of yeshiva, you know, you're never going to have this time. And you know, we got a little cynical about that. Oh, right, these old guys come in and they give us this shmooze about the best year. So now that I am around the age of those guys who used to come in, I can tell you, indeed, it's 1,000% the truth. Because when a person thinks, they'll be, you know, now I have worries, I'm not married yet. Like a person always says, you know, all right, now, when I get married and I have a home and I'm settled, you know, then I'm going to be able to shteig. But, you know, right now, you know, I don't have a bias. You know, the truth of the matter is, you know, there's always going to be an excuse. That when you're married, well, I have a wife to take care of, and then you become a parent, I have kids to take care of. You know, the truth of the matter is, there is no time in your life when it is as easy to really learn and immerse yourself as when, you know, you don't have attachments and you don't have obligations. Of course, every part of life has opportunities too. You know, you don't say, when I get married, I'll forget about it, it's too late. You know, of course you don't say that either. But the point is that the illusion that when I finish college, I'll have more time when I have a regular job. You know, it doesn't, that doesn't work out that way. So this is just very simple common sense wisdom that a person has to be machshev every minute of life. And then, of course, in a more dramatic sense, there's a, you know, there was a famous, you know, in Europe, the rav of a city did not give drushes. It was interesting. It was not a job of a rav. Like in America, if you ask somebody, you know, make a list of the most important thing a shul rabbi does, they'll say, oh, he has to give a sermon, you know, etc. Just to show you, Niskatnu Adiris, if you look at the requirements of sermons in the 1920s and 30s, so they would typically state a minimum. A rabbi must speak for at least 20 minutes on Shabbos. That was the job. Now they say the rabbi must speak no more than 20 minutes. It's interesting how they changed the contract. But be this as it may, a rabbi in Europe was a paisek, and a rabbi in Europe was not a darshan. A rabbi only spoke twice a year. Although they were very long drushes, Shabbos Hagadol and Shabbos Shuvah. It was not a Rav's kavod to stamaza, you know, give vardlich on the parsha. So what they had was they had magidim, right? They had magidim. They had now some of the magidim were itinerant. They would go from city to city, and some big cities actually had people who were magidim. Some of the magidim were very big talmidei chachamim. Where you know the magid of Dubna was a very good personal friend of the Vilna Gaon. And the Vilna Gaon would actually ask him for private Musr sessions. Come in and give me Musr. Imagine this, you're asked to give Musr to the Vilna Gaon. And, you know, there's this famous story that Dubna Magid said to him, okay, you can learn so much because you're not involved in people's problems, you're not in the street, you don't, you know, people don't go to you about personal issues, but try to be involved in people's lives and then see how much you're going to be able to learn. And the Vilna Gaon started crying. He says, you're right. He says, I don't know if I would be Aimed Ben Nisayan, you know, etc. But there were magidim. So one of the most famous magidim of the 1800s, the 19th century, was a Talmud of Yisrael Salanter. He was almost the same age, but he was kind of a Talmud chaver of Yisrael Salanter. He was called the Magid of Kelim. Now this is a little confusing, because Yisrael Salanter's most famous devoted Talmud is called the Altar of Kelim. But the Altar of Kelim is not the same as the Magid of Kelim. The Altar of Kelim was 100% a Talmud who was mevatel himself to Yisrael Salanter in all ways. The Magid of Kelim was, you know, independent. He already was a famous Magid before he met Rav Yisrael, but Rav Yisrael had a hashpah in his derech. But the Magid of Kelim was what you might call a fire and brimstone person. He was very dramatic, and he painted amazing, amazing pictures that would really arouse people to tshuva and the like. So we have a record of one of the drushes he gave, that he would come to a city, and he would talk to the Rav, and he would say, what are the problems in the Kehillah? What is the Kehillah Nichshol in? Maybe they need Chizuk in Shemirah Shabbos, or Kashrus, or Lashon Hara, Ben Adam L'Chaveira. And, you know, he would talk to the Rav, which means the Rav, even though the Rav didn't darshan, the Rav has to be aware of what needs Chizuk and what needs Tikkun, and he would try to incorporate it in his Musar, in his drusha, and the like. But because a Magid was a kind of a popular speaker, so the Magid also had to incorporate things that would be Meishich people's interest. It couldn't just Stamazai be They're supposed to have to be either jokes or stories. So the Maggid of Kelim used what you might call drama, psychodrama. And he tells the story. He says there was a Maisa that he pointed to the Beis HaKvaros that you could see from the shul's windows, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was Machaye all the Maisim in the Beis HaKvaros. And he gave them 1/2 hour to be Masaking what they were not Masaking in their lifetimes. And he described it much more dramatically than I'm describing it. And all of the Maisim came. Imagine if a person was able to come back from the other world and they were given 1/2 hour, do what you can. Like once you have that din b'cheshbon, you know exactly what it is that you didn't do or have to do. So he says people were running around like crazy, you know, the mason. That some people, you know, went into the Beis Medrash and they pulled out a Gemara to try to chaperein, you know, learning, because even a little bit of learning can be a tremendous aliyah. And others went to ask mechila from all the people they hurt, and they went to their wives and they went to their children or their business associates or their customers, and they're running around giving tzedakah and the like. And as they're running around with so much tension, they're looking at the clock. 29 minutes left, 28 minutes left, and it gets much more frenetic as the clock is winding down. And finally, there's only 2 minutes left and people are running around looking desperately for some mitzvah, some maisa taiv, some zechus they could bring with them, like one more mitzvah, just one more. Because once you're in Olam Haba, you don't have that opportunity. And then there was the countdown, you know, the Maggid is saying, you know, 10, 9, you know, 8, 7, you know, it's going down to 0. And then, as the Mason was nigzar, that all the Mason have to go back to the Beis HaKvaros. And there was a huge cry and moan and wailing, because the opportunity was lost forever, at least until there's Gilgal, whatever it is, but without getting into the issue of Gilgal, it was lost. Whatever they did, they did. And whatever they didn't do, they didn't do. And that's going to be it. It was a miracle they were given a second chance. But that's going to be it. So the way he expressed this mashal, and he talked about people's grandparents and their parents, you know, all in that basic verse. So people were sobbing and weeping. And he ended his drasha and he says, and Rabbi Isai, what is so bad if Hashem gave us more than 1/2 hour? To rectify the mistakes of our life. And then he said, and who says Hashem gave you 1/2 hour? Who says? And the point is the chashivas of zman. The chashivas of zman. An amazing thing. You know, killing time is really suicide. I mean, what is life? What is life but time? The succession of time. You kill time. You kill yourself. And, you know, there's a midrash that says, you know, for every part of Briyas HaOlam, the pasuk says, V'yara l'kib kitov. Hashem said, kitov, it was good. At the very end of Briya, after Adam was created, it says, V'yara l'kib es kol asher asa. Hashem saw everything that he made. V'hine tov ma'od. It was very good. So people ask Akasha, well, good plus good plus good doesn't mean very good. If everything individually is good, then, well, how could everything be very good? Like if you have, let's say, a C on every college course, so the average of C is C. The average of good is good. It's Tov. It's not going to be Tov Ma'od. So there's a medrash that says, yes, Tov Ma'od is a cherry that Hashem added to the totality of Bria. That is, he added death. Death converted the Tov to the Tov Mi'od. Now, the Medrash itself is very shver, even in Pshat, because the Chumash indicates that had there not been the Chet of other Marishon, there would not have been death. And yet the Medrash is bringing in death in the words Tov Ma'od, which is prior to the Chet of other Madah. So in Pshat, it's a difficult Medrash. But the Medrash is making a point, and the point is, it is death that makes life tov ma'od. How is that so? We might think the opposite. If we care, death is something bad. It makes life not perfect. The answer is no. Because it is death, Taka, that gives a person a sense of the preciousness of every moment. If a person lived forever, you know, you could put off things. I'll get to it, 10,000 years. The next millennium, I'll take care of it. What are you bothering me right now? But in life, there has to be a sense of urgency. Now again, one has to be careful that it doesn't become pathological. In other words, a healthy person is not supposed to constantly think, God forbid, I might die the next second. Otherwise you can't. In fact, I knew a case like that. By the way, now, the person was not religious at all. But it was a boy I knew, nothing to do with Ertzemeya, just a boy I knew, who, unfortunately, was diagnosed with AIDS because of behavior of his parents. In other words, he was born, his parents were drug addicts or whatever it would be, and because of the needles, it passed into the baby. The baby was born with AIDS. Now, what happened was kind of a miracle that he's cured now, meaning he's already 25. According to the diagnosis, he should have died when he was 2. But he never really got his life together, because every day he thought he was going to die. So as a result, he says, well, what's the use of going to school? What's the use of getting a job? I'm going to die, So that's an example of the other way around, where a person gets so paralyzed by death that they don't go weiter. That's obviously a bad thing. But there's another aspect where Zechiras Yom HaMisa is a good thing, because that gives a person a sense of preciousness. Al taimer l'chefne eshne shemaloti pane. And that can mean a lot of things. There'll be a lot of distractions, but it can also mean we don't know, how much time we have. We got to use it in a good, positive way. That is why Shlomo HaMelech says in Koheles, Tov l'leches l'beis ha'avel mi'leches l'beis ha'mishneh. It is better to go to the house of the mourner than to the house of a party. Because that reminds us of the preciousness of life. That's a very, very significant point. So when a person has an opportunity, we try not to put it off. And that's in Torah, that's in Chesed, that's in Avas Yisrael, that's in making mechila, making amends for the people that we've hurt. We never know. We don't know about them. We don't know about us, etc. And that is why the Medrash says that Tov Ma'od is Misa. Quite a remarkable statement. It is Misa that makes all of life Tov Miot. And that's what the Maggid said. Hashem B'derech Klal gave us more than a half an hour. Baruch Hashem. But we don't even know that. Okay, yeah, I don't want to make people depressed anyway. They say Rav Chaim had a constant pachad of Misa. Rav Chaim was always being Zeicher Yom HaMisa because it was Yerushalayim, but it sometimes got to him. So they say Rav Chaim's solution for the depression was he was Isaac a lot in Ayolus, Masachas Ayolus, which deals with the intricacies of Tumas Meis. And we have some very, very famous, very intricate Shtiklech Torah of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik on the Dinam of Tumas Ayol. So it's interesting to know that that was how he dealt with the pachad, by taking those thoughts and utilizing them as a chelik of his Torah learning in and of itself. Okay, so that's the Al Tishalul B'Yom Machor. Don't assume you'll be able to accomplish things tomorrow. Bez Hashem, you will, but take care of today first. Now, the next pasuk, again, some of these pasuk were not directly connected. Yahalelcha zor v'laypicha nachri v'yalsufasecha. So it seems to be saying the same thing twice, but it says that let other people praise you and not your own mouth. Nachri also means a stranger and not your own lips. Again, the Gra doesn't give us a full pshat here, but the Gra tells us the following. Sufasayim, lips, are external. Right? The lips are outside. The peh refers to the inside of the mouth. He then says, a zor and a nachri. A zor is someone other than you, but who is familiar with your inner life. Meaning, if you have somebody in your house, chavrusa, someone that comes into your house, we can call him a zor, because he's not you, but he's still with you. A nachri, which often means a guy, is somebody who only knows you from the outside and doesn't know you from the inside. So the Gra says there's a certain symmetry. In a life, there is what is called panemios, and there is what is called chitzonios. Right? There are aspects of our life that are internal, that are private, that are modest, that are not widely known. And then there are aspects of our life in which the public may know. For example, we run a business or we give a share, whatever it is we do, there may be a certain aspect of ourselves that is more publicly known. So it says that that corresponds to picha. So picha is panemius, and the Zohar is the person who knows your panemius. The Nochri is the chitzonius. So it's basically saying, live your life in which you become a life that is worthy of being praised, both in your panemius and your chitzonius. Now, again, that's an important practical lesson. There are many people, maybe most of us, we define chesed and kindness by what we do outside of our families, outside of our homes. You sometimes have people who try to be very big balei chesed in terms of what they do for other people, but they're not necessarily kind to their wives or to their children, because they say, well, that's not chesed, that's family, that's a different chesed. And that would be an example of a person who is praiseworthy in chitzonius, but not necessarily panemius. That's one example. Or sometimes a person might literally be echad bepech v'echad b'lev, meaning they might behave like a righteous person on the outside, but inside not. Now, that doesn't mean necessarily, maybe hypocrite is not the right word, that doesn't necessarily mean they're trying to deceive people. Maybe they're genuinely trying to be good, but there are a lot of moments in their private life where they just don't live to that madrega. So what the pasuk is saying is, be praiseworthy not only on the outside, but also on the inside, and you should not be the source of praising yourself. In other words, live a life in which people will look at you and say, that is a Kiddush Hashem. Right? The marker for that is in the Torah itself. We say in Kriya Shema, V'yahavta eis Hashem alekecha, you shall love Hashem. So the Gemara in Yuma darshins that V'yahavta can also be reread to mean, you shall make the name of Hashem beloved in the mouths of others. What does that mean? That you live your life in such a way that a person looks at you and says, if that is what the Torah teaches, the Torah is a good thing. Yiddishkeit is a good thing. Hashem is a wise and great God that has given people a way to live their life. That is called Kiddush Hashem. And that is based on, besides the pasuk that says, Beferish v'nikdashti, but that's not only martyrdom. People think Kiddush Hashem is only, you know, if I give up my life, although it is that as well, the three cardinal averos. But the positive aspect of Kiddush Hashem is that the name of Hashem should be Misahev al Yadecha. And the other way around, a person behaves in such a way that people look at him and say, if that's what a Torah Jew does, I want nothing to do with that. It's disgusting, it's unpleasant, it's rude. So that, chas v'shalom, is the definition of a chilum Hashem. Rabbi Yashiv said, a few years ago, before he was nifter, Rabbi Yashiv said, that making the name of Hashem beloved in the eyes of others is the central avodas Hashem of religious Jews in the world today. Central. Because, I mean, number one, how do you bring a person to Torah unless you can convey that type of attitude? What's going to be? If Yiddishkeit gets conveyed as something that's rude, disparaging, mean, inconsiderate, so somebody's going to want to join that? Sometimes, yes. Sometimes the way it works is a person might be so convinced of the truth of the Torah that they might ignore the individual behavior of Jews. In fact, there's a famous statement, don't judge Judaism by Jews. No? Yeah, some say that. So sometimes a strong person might come to Yiddishkeit even with all the bad examples that they see. But b'derech klal, what is moshech a person, are the examples of righteousness and goodness that they see in the lives of people who adhere to Torah. So when we don't show, when we're not examples of that, then chas v'shalom, we're driving people away. There's a beautiful statement from the Alter of Kelim, not the Maggid of Kelim, the Alter of Yisrael Salanter's Talmud, the Alter of Kelim. And I love this statement because, I mean, in a way, we'd almost put our Sameach out of business, but it's a great, great statement. The Altruf Kelm lived shortly after Darwin published The Origin of Species, which is the book that articulates the theory of evolution. So somebody asked the Altruf Kelm, you know, what is the Torah's view on evolution? So he said the following. He didn't deal with the science at all. He said, Darwin believed that man came from ape only because he never met Rabbi Saul Salanter. He says, if he would have met Rabbi Saul Salanter, that alone would have convinced him that only God could have made such a person. Such a person cannot arise by natural selection. Now that's a very interesting thought, because what that's saying is that a lot of times it is not necessarily the technical science or the technical philosophy that brings a person to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but it's just being hit in the face with Kedusha and goodness. And then you work backwards. Okay, so now I'll try to figure out how this system works, and then you get into the different arguments. It's not the arguments to make a person from. It's the sense of Kedusha. Now again, so the problem basically is, you know, we're not always zoche to encounter that, we're not zoche to see that, that's an issue. But I mean, forgive me for repeating, I'm sure over the years I've repeated Meissen many, many times, but I may have said this even recently, if I have recollection, but I tell over very often my encounter with Rav Moshe Feinstein when I was a 9-year-old child. That he had he had a nephew in Hartford, Connecticut. And there were a number of years he would go to Hartford, Connecticut for 2 or 3 weeks in the summer just to be there. Now, he didn't stay by his nephew. His nephew was more modern. He stayed by a rabbi, but he went to visit his nephew, but he stayed by a more Haredi rav. But I was in fourth grade, the year that I remember that Rav Moshe was there, that I was old enough to at least be cognizant of. And I was in the car. I would daven on my way to school. We would daven, instead of davening in school, we'd daven in the shul on the way to school, and then I'd walk to school. So I was zocha to be in the car with Rav Moshe every morning for 2 or 3 weeks. And there were things that I saw. I would like stare at him and I would watch him, because there were things that I thought I had never seen in my life before. When he would wrap up his tefillin after Aleinu, he would be learning Mishnah. I had never seen the concept of somebody looking in a sefer while he's wrapping up tefillin. Even between Aliyahs, he would have a Mishnah. He was only learning Mishnah. That's what he did. He would have a Mishnah open between the Aliyahs, then he would close it. Like I had never seen that concept of learning every second. That was like an unbelievable thing. But this particular story I have is that one day there was davening, and davening was over, and I was still davening, I was going to go to school, and it was raining that day. Now, from this shul to the school, it was only 4 blocks. Walking in the rain was no big deal. I don't mind walking in the rain now. I certainly didn't mind it. Didn't mind it then. But Rav Moshe had already been taken home, but he sent the driver back. He said, the car come back. As Rav Moshe said, he remembered there was a little boy in the car, and he didn't want you to walk in the rain. He asked me if I would come back and take you to school so you shouldn't have to walk. Now here, and I mean, no other adult, you know, happened to notice that even. Here you have the Gadol Hador, who all of the shilas of Klal Yisrael are on Rav Moshe Feinstein's shoulders. They used to say, every rabbi that got smicha in America, it's a joke because it's not true, because I don't have it on my smicha, had Rav Moshe Feinstein's phone number on the back. it was a joke, but there was a lot of truth in it. I mean, Rav Moshe was the posek. Even Gedolim, Rav Shlomo Zalman and Rav Yashiv were mevatel themselves. I mean, they were cholik sometimes, but they were mevatel themselves to Rav Moshe in Psak Halacha and the like. And yet, this great, great, phenomenal gadol who didn't waste a minute was someone who noticed the fact that a child, you know, didn't want a child to walk in the rain for a few blocks. So, you know what type of impression that makes? I mean, this is a phenomenal impression that you see this is godless, this is Torah. This is, you know, someone that, you know, we can hope to be like in some way, not in as godless in Torah, but at least in those midos. And that makes a greater, greater impression than almost any brilliant sheer or any brilliant analysis and the like, because it is the reality of Kedusha that penetrates deeper. And therefore, what Shlomo HaMelech is saying is, live a life that people will look at you and they will say, if that's what Yiddishkeit is, that's a good thing. Now, maybe they'll become frum, maybe they won't. But at least they'll be a Kiddush Hashem. And if they don't become frum, maybe they'll send their child to a day school because they met somebody who, you know, sent a car back to take them to school when it was raining. Sometimes it may be the next generation or a generation after that. They say Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky was once at a doctor's, and there was like a non-religious woman with her child there, and Rav Yaakov was rolling a ball to the child. He was playing ball with the child. And somebody asked him, like, "You know, you're a Rosh Hashiva. Why are you playing?" He says, "Because maybe this child will remember one day that there was an old rabbi with a beard who played ball with him. And maybe the child will think about, you know, maybe I should send my child to a day school because, you know, this old rabbi was such a nice person." We don't think in those terms, but that's why it's said that to a gadol, there is no such thing as small things. To great people, everything is great, everything is important. It is only to small people that there are small matters. To great people, everything is great. Everything is significant. The yachid is as great as the tzibur and the like. So these are things to think about. Both in but again, there's also a lesson here of Zohar and Nachri, of chitzonius and pnimius, and that is one has to be concerned for their family. You know, and again, this is part of a much longer shmos. I'll tell you two short stories about that. There was a fellow who got married in Kailo. And he went to Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, and he said, "You know, my wife wants me to take out the garbage on the way to Kailo, and you know, I'm happy to help her, but you know, it's not really kavodik, a ben Torah, a person who learns, you know, has to deal with dignity. The Rambam says Talmud Chacham should be dignified, and it's not mavuza." So Rav Chaim Shmulevitz said to him, "No, you're really right. You're right, taka." So anyway, the next morning, around 6:30 in the morning, there's a ring on his doorbell, and he, you know, he's on his way to davening. He opens up the door, and the Rosh Hashiva is there. Rav Chaim Shmulevitz is there. He can't believe it. He says to Rav Chaim, he says, "I'm very, very honored, but what can I do for the Rosh Hashiva? Is something wrong?" The Rosh Hashiva said, "You know, you're right. A man like you should not take out the garbage. I'm here to take it out for you." So the person absorbed a certain lesson. That, you know, for Shalom Bias, to be helpful, you do what you need to do. You know, you don't start talking about your kavod and the like. Now, if the wife herself, you know, has such deep respect and awe for the husband, that's a separate thing. In other words, whether that should be her, in other words, maybe it might be her avayit on some level, but it's not his avayit. His avayit is not to be makbid about his kavod. The other nekuda is a vort from the Stipler, that somebody asked the Stipler that, you know, he said his wife needed him to be around a lot, etc., and he felt there was a bittul Torah. So he said like this, he said that Hatzlacha in Torah depends on your Deveikus to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The closer you are to Hashem, the more you emulate Hashem's ways, the more Hatzlacha you will have in understanding Hashem's Seichel. Hashem's Seichel is the Torah. When you're Davuk B'Hashem, you understand the Torah more. And a person is davak with HaKadosh Baruch Hu's midos when he is a gomel chesed. So the Stipler said, if you help your wife 2 hours a day, and you may think you lose 2 hours of learning, Hashem will allow you to make up in less time. I mean, let's say, for example, I would learn, my morning seder is 4 hours, and I have to take off. Now, we're not talking about every day, but I have to take off like 2 hours. He says, those 2 hours you will do, the 2 hours that you're learning, you will accomplish what would have taken you 4 hours. He says, you're not going to lose by the chesed that you give to those who need it. Now, again, do not take this word totally at face value, because it depends on whether you have a halachic dispensation. I mean, again, let me go over this. In order to be Mevatel Torah, you need a heter. Now, one of the heterim for Bittul Torah is a mitzvah that cannot be done by anybody else. So if my wife needs me in a way that somebody else cannot fill the gap, then there is a heter of Talmud Torah, and then the stipler says that Hashem will give you the siyata dishmaya to make up in less time what you would have learned in that normal time. But if it's a type of thing that does not require your active involvement, etc., in other words, that's a cheshbon that one has to address. Otherwise, one might say, you know, my wife would like me to be home all the time. Because, you know, obviously at some point you're going to have to ask a shayla, you know, how much bittul. But the concept that when one is mevatel Torah to help their spouse, that's like a real bad, negative thing, that's really the wrong attitude, because one is emulating the midah of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We find Rav Shach, big gedolim, Rav Shach, you know, would take off to do things for his Rebbetzin when she needed it, the stipler. They did it. B'sever panim yafos, not with resentment, and they saw this as emulating the midah of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and they considered it to be a proper aspect of Avodas Hashem, and one should look at it in that way as well. So that's also the idea of chitzainius and panimius. Skip down a little bit to Pasuk Hey. Pasuk Hey is actually a very, very famous pasuk, but it's famous because the Ramban brings it in the Hakdama to his Perush al Torah, and it's kind of in a humorous way. So unfortunately, this shows you our Tanakh illiteracy. my Tanakh illiteracy. You know, we know this pasuk because the Ramban brings it in the Hakdama to the Chumash instead of knowing. It's like the person knows the Gemara because the Ketos HaChoshen brings it down, you know, it's like, instead of knowing the Gemara directly. But the pasuk can be translated two ways. Tova tochachas migula me'ahava misutaret. Tochachas migula is open rebuke. An open rebuke that is not hidden. Now, me'ava mo'ava misuteres means hidden love. So open rebuke is better than hidden love. Now, let me just explain the ambiguity. The prefix ma can be interpreted as then or from, meaning you could translate this verse two ways. An open rebuke is better than hidden love, and I'll explain that. THIN, better than hidden love. Or an open rebuke is good from, when it comes from hidden love. You see, the mem can be a then, which would make it comparative. You're saying this is better than that. Or it can be saying this is good when it comes from that. Mem, in fact, whenever you see a mem like this, a mem prefix, you always ask yourself, is this a comparative mem? I'll give you another example. It says, Yisron ha'or min ha'choshech. So that could mean light is better than darkness, or light is good when it comes after darkness, because then you appreciate it, right? Okay. Now let's take both pshatim. The first pshat, an open rebuke is better than hidden love, which is not the way Chazal understand it. That simply says the following, that when somebody is open and honest with me, even if it's critical and even if it's difficult, at least I know how to deal with it. Now, I know it in different ways. If the person is telling me something that is legitimate, that I need to correct, so I'll correct it. If the person is accusing me of things in which I have no shaychus to at all, then I'll know to ignore and be merachik myself from it. So either way, open criticism kind of tells you how to deal with this person, either in the direction of improving myself or in the direction of staying away from him, or if there's a third possibility, to dialogue with him to try to see why he misunderstands, right? That's what the union of tochacha is, not only to give musar, it's also to create channels of communication. On the other hand, when someone loves me a lot, but he doesn't show it in any possible way, then what am I gaining from that relationship? I don't even know that love is there. This is a common issue with husbands and wives sometimes in marriage counseling, where the husband does not express. And it's kind of, well, you know how I feel, you know. The point is, you can't have ava misuteres, that sometimes love has to be expressed. And sometimes even negativity that's expressed can be better than hidden love that is concealed. That is one pshat. Now, the second pshat is a different translation. It is not comparing. It's not a comparative. It's not comparing open rebuke versus hidden love. But it's saying when the open rebuke comes from hidden love, it's a good thing. And that is, there are two types of tokacha. When I give tokacha because I want to put you down, I want to humiliate you, I want to cut you down, that's not going to produce anything good. That'll just create bitterness, animosity. But when the tokacha comes from hidden love, even though it appears sharp, then the person who is makabel that understands that it comes from love, and he will respond accordingly. See, it's a different translation. In other words, tova does not mean better. It rather is simply saying, open rebuke is good when it comes from hidden love. Implication, tokacha is bad when it does not come from love. This is actually one of the reasons the poskim say we tend to be relatively lenient in the mitzvah d'oraisa of giving people tokacha. There's a mitzvah in the Torah. I see somebody doing something wrong, I am supposed to be mochiach. And yet, by and large, we're not mochiach that much today. And part of the reason is that if your tokacha, if you are not sure that your tokacha is coming from love, then it's better to be quiet, simply because your tokacha may drive a person away. It may be worse. And the one thing you can't do with tokacha is make things worse. That would be... Now, if all it would do is be neutral, there would still be an argument. Be mochiach v'kavod shamayim. In other words, even if it's not going to be effective, you know, say it anyway. But if it's going to make it worse, you exactly don't do it at all. And this is a new thing. I mean, I'm sorry, this is not a new thing. Already in the time of the Gemara, Tanoim, somebody asked Rabbi Akiva, how come nobody knows how to be makabel good tokacha today? No one's makabel criticism. Rabbi Akiva said, because nobody knows how to give tokacha, and that's why nobody is makabel tokacha. So, you got to be careful. I know our Samech Talmidim enjoy giving tokacha for some reason. I'm not sure why, because there's not a single Rebbe I know that relishes this responsibility, but the boys like to do it a lot. And you need to be very, 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 very careful, because a misplaced tokacha can actually undo many, many months, if not years, my friend, of you know, growth and hadracha, because the person feels spat upon, the person feels denigrated, the person feels insulted, the person feels delegitimated. And tokacha has to come me'ava misuteret. Now, in this connection, let me just mention the Ramban's context. It's a very interesting the way the Ramban uses this pasuk. It's a brilliant use of the pasuk. The Ramban writes in his introduction to Chumash that he will be basing his commentary on two Meforshim. Besides Chazal, the two Meforshim are Rashi and the Ibn Ezra. So with Rashi, he then writes, you know, Rashi is the source, Rashi is great, Rashi is the menorah of Klal Yisrael. Then, with respect to the Ibn Ezra, who the Ramban argues with all the time, he says, and of Ravram Ibn Ezra, my approach will be, tochacha megula miyava misuteret. Meaning to say, I will have much to criticize, but it comes from a hidden love. So that's the phrase the Ramban uses this pasuk with his gisha with the Ibn Ezra. Yeah.
Yaakov Avinu, he wanted to give tochacha, I think, to Reuben, but he was afraid to do it because he might go to Esau.
Yeah, that's right. Even Yaakov Avinu had a certain pachad. So you have to be careful. Now that doesn't mean, again, that doesn't mean we simply write out, black out a mitzvah in the Torah. Obviously, there are going to be times for tochacha, but you have to know when, and you have to know the context, and it has to come from love, and not coming from condemnation. In fact, that's marumas in the Chumash itself. Hocheach tochiach es amisecha. You shall rebuke or chastise your friend, amisecha. Meaning only if it can be done in a bridge of friendship, then you do it. Otherwise, one should not be mochiach. So those are the two translations. Does it mean that open rebuke is better than concealed love? Or does it mean open rebuke is effective only when it comes from a concealed love that is in sight? The next pasuk is also a well-known pasuk, Gemara in Tainus, that's a drasha. Ne'amanim pitzei ohe v'nataros neshikas sonim. Pitzei ohe, pitzei are the wounds. Pitzei ohev are wounds that are inflicted by a lover. So better are the wounds inflicted by a lover. And Taurus is an unusual word, but it seems to mean superfluous, is how Rashi translates it, are the kisses of an enemy. Better take the slaps of somebody who cares about me than the kisses and embraces of someone who really hates me. And here, the Gemara in Tainus has a very, very interesting practical interpretation of this pasuk. And it points out that, you see, let's compare Bilam, right? Bilam was somebody who hated the Jewish people. Bilam was hired to curse Klal Yisrael. And Hashem turned every curse of Bilam into a bracha. But the Gemara says, the brachos of Bilam, who hated us, are worse than the curses of the Navi Achia HaShiloni, who loved us. And it compares the following way. Bilam gave us a bracha. We are like cedars. Karazim Nata Hashem. We are strong and mighty like the cedars. Achia HaShiloni was a Navi, at the time of Yeravam ben Nevat. He was the one who actually anointed Yeravam, the splitting away of the kingdom. Right? He was the Navi that created the Pirut, the separation between the 10 tribes and Malchus Beis David. And Achia Shilaini cursed the Malchus of Yehuda because of their Averos. And he said, they should be like a reed, or if you have a reed that just blows in the wind every single direction, they should have no rest, they should just blow around. So it seems Bilam is better. In fact, Bilam blesses us to be a strong, firm cedar tree, and Achia Shiloni curses us to be like a reed that moves around. But the Gemara says that even the curse of the one who loves us is better than the blessing of the one who hates us. Because a cedar is very, very strong. But once you have a strong enough wind, let it be a tsunami, let it be a hurricane or something, it just gets blown over. Because it's inflexible, meaning the tree is firmly fixed. Once it gets knocked down, it can't like bounce back. A reed moves around. Yeah, it gets agitated. But that's its very strength, that it can be blown around here and there. But because it's flexible, it goes with the wind, it moves with the wind, it has the ability to survive even the worst conditions. So there's a remez here. And in fact, the Gemara in Tainus quotes this pasuk, Nemanin pitzayayev, that the ohev that is beating me up, it's still coming out of love. Now, this is an interesting point to apply it by Bilam, because after all, it was Hashem. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it's not like, if this would have been Bilam's own words, so you could say, you know, Bilam said what he said, but if it's Hashem that put those words in Bilam's mouth, why would we look at Bilam's hatred? But you see that somehow this is the nature of Nevuah. The nature of Nevuah is that Nevuah is filtered through the peculiarities of the Navi's own neshama. See, that's the difference, actually, between Moshe Rabbeinu's Nevuah and every other Navi. Moshe Rabbeinu's Nevuah was a word for word for word. Hashem told Moshe the exact words of his Nevuah. Other Nevi'im, even though they say, Kol Amar Hashem, this is what God says, etc., the way many Meforshim understand it is they have visions which they then put into their own words. But they are their own words, and how a Navi perceives his vision is a function of the uniqueness of their neshama. So even though Bilam is clearly getting the message to bless Bnei Yisrael, and he can't deny that, you must bless Bnei Yisrael, but the particular form of the blessing will be filtered through the hatred that he has, and it will express itself as Erez, which on one hand is majestic and strong and powerful, but there's a bit of a remez that it can also be broken. That's an interesting point. Now, although now that I'm speaking this out loud, l'chaira, there is a kasha. What I just said is actually true for a Nevi'im. In fact, that is a true point. In fact, it's an interesting point that a Navi does not get a word-for-word Nevuah from Hashem. A Navi gets images which he puts into his own language. But Rav Yehoshua Leib Diskin, the great Maharil Diskin, B'davka said in Bilam that wasn't the case. And he says the following. He quotes a Gemara in Bava Basra. The Gemara in Bava Basra, if you remember, some of you may have learned it, the end of the first perek talks about the authorship of the different books of Tanakh. Who wrote the different books? So it says, Moshe Rabbeinu, of course, Al Pi Hashem, wrote, it says, Sifro, which is the Torah, Uparsha Spilam. And he also wrote the Parsha of Bilam, meaning Hashem told him what to write. You wrote the Parsha of Bilam. And then there's a machlokas in the Gemara who wrote the last eight verses that talk about Moshe Rabbeinu dying. Well, one says Yoshua wrote them, another says Moshe wrote them. So Rav Shmuel Leib Diskin asks Akasha, what do you mean? Moshe wrote the whole Torah and Moshe wrote the Parsha of Bilam. The Parsha of Bilam is in the Torah. He wrote the whole Torah except for the last eight verses. Right. Why are you separating out the Parsha of Bilam as if it is not part of the Torah? So Rav Yehoshua Leib Diskin offers the following explanation. He says, all of the Torah was given to Moshe on the level of what Chazal call Aspaklaria HaMe'ira, an absolute clear perception of the divine. Aspaklari Mira means there was only one lens between Moshe and God. In other words, the fact that Moshe was a human, was a physical body, meant he couldn't have 100%. But the absolute closest that any human being could ever have of the Shekhinah was Moshe Rabbeinu. All other Nevi'im perceived God through an Aspaklariya She'ena Mira, multiple lenses, cloudy. So Rav Shmuel Leib Diskin says the following. That means the following interesting point. When Moshe Rabbeinu writes down in the Torah about what Hashem said to Abraham, Moshe Rabbeinu understood what Hashem said to Abraham more than Abraham understood what Hashem said to Abraham. Because Abraham perceived divinity through Aspaklaria She'ena Me'ira, and Moshe perceived that same divinity through an Aspaklaria Me'ira. But the one exception was, and that's why the Torah is called Sifro. It is Moshe's Sefer. Because even though in that Sefer we have the Nevuahs that were said to Avram, to Yitzchak, to Yaakov, Moshe understood them all on a higher level than even they did. But with Bilam, Chazal say that Bilam was equal in Nevuah to Moshe Rabbeinu himself. So the nation shouldn't say, if you would have given us a Navi like Moshe, we wouldn't have sinned. As a result, Moshe Rabbeinu's understanding of Bilam's Nevuah was no greater than Bilam's understanding. As a result, we call them Bilam's Nevuah. See, I don't call it Avram's Nevuah, I call it Moshe's Nevuah, because Moshe understood every Nevuah in the Torah greater than the person that was said to. But in the case of Bilam, Bilam was equal, and therefore it's called. So that's in a sense, that's contradicting what I just said, because if Bilam had absolute clarity what Hashem was telling him to do, then he wouldn't have put in hatred, right? So l'chaira, my husband does not fit Rav Shul Leib Diskin. But again, Rav Shul Leib Diskin is not a medrash. I mean, this is just a pshat that he wanted to say to be miyashev the Gemara by Sefer Bilam. By the way, people ask Akasha. He says, l'chaira, why does Hashem make Bilam such a great navi? Because people are going to say, if you would have given us a prophet like Moshe, then we would also be righteous. So he gives them Bilam. So let them say, well, our question is, if you would give us a prophet like Moshe, we would be righteous. So your answer to that is, you give us a prophet like Bilam? Good, Bilam was a great prophet in prophecy as Moshe, but he wasn't as righteous as Moshe. Right? Hashem didn't really address the issue. But the answer is this. The answer is, you may want to say the following, that both Bilam and Moshe may have been perhaps equally righteous before they were made Nevi'im. And Bilam took the Nevuah and made him a Baal Gaiva, it made him selfish, etc. In other words, yeah, Hashem said, I'm going to take two people, give both of them the koach of Nevuah. One is going to destroy, but that's Bechira. He could have been a Moshe Rabbeinu. He decided not to. So what do you want? That is the idea of human Bechira. Okay. But this is the Gemara in Tainus. Achia Hashilayim are the Pitzei Ohev, and Bilam, the Neshikais, the apparent kisses of the Sonia.
The fact that Bilam could have cursed and Moshe Rabbeinu, he did not have his power, or he had his power? Does that mean that Bilam had a mila over Moshe Rabbeinu? I heard it said that Moshe Rabbeinu had the power to bless, Bilam had the power to curse.
Well, no, I mean, Moshe Rabbeinu could have cursed too if he wanted to, but he didn't want it.
He had this power also?
Yeah, I assume that whatever power Bilam had, Moshe Rabbeinu had as well. You know, the Chafetz Chaim, I think I mentioned last week even, people used to go to the Chafetz Chaim, they would ask him to curse people. Curse the Tsar, curse whatever it is, because they thought the Chafetz Chaim's curse would just finish people off. And the Chafetz Chaim refused. He said he will not use the kayach of klala against anybody. Although they say there was one person who used it against, it was against a Jewish person, who he felt tried to be machdiyim as a young boy tried to take him away from Yiddishkeit. But the Chafetz Chaim said that the kayach of curse is a real kayach, but a yid should not use the kayach of curse even against the enemies of Hashem. Yeah.
When I was mourning for my mother, I was in the Shlius Tzibur. And I was told that when I say the Mal Shanim, that I should say it in a lower voice than the other voices. So
really?
Maybe that whoever told me this, they didn't have a Masorah on it. But my brisk student friend said, where does that come from? And maybe it's related to this, or maybe it was just somebody misinforming me.
Yeah, was that here in Yerushalayim or something?
No, it was in the Bronx.
It's interesting. Maybe they didn't want the shkutzim there to hear what you were saying. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you. I will tell you a thought from Rav Kook, which is quite beautiful. If you remember, of Lamal Shinim was the last bracha added to Shmone Esrei, right? And this was in the time of Rabban Gamliel of Yavne. This is after the Chorban Beis Hamikdash, and the Sanhedrin is in Yavne. And Rabban Gamliel is very concerned for what are called minim. What are the minim? Maybe the early Christians, missionaries, apostates, abikorsim, informers. And he said, who will make a bracha against all of these bad people? And he couldn't find somebody. He says, who can make such a bracha? So finally, he identifies one man, Shmuel HaKatan, Shmuel the Humble. And Shmuel HaKatan is the author of Lamal Shinim. This is Gemara in Brachos. This is the 19th bracha of the Shmone Esrei. So Rav Kook used to ask, he says, What's so difficult? I mean, whoever wrote the other brachas. I mean, the original brachas were written by the Anshei Knesset Hagdola, but then Shimon HaPakuli revised them, because you understand why there's a need for a revision. The Anshei Knesset Hagdola were in the beginning of the Bayis Sheni. So the form of the Amida then was not the Nusach we have now. In other words, they didn't say, V'liyushalayim ircha barachamim tashuv. They just asked Hashem to bless the existing city. So that is why the Gemara indicates that in the time of Rabban Gamliel of Yavne, they had to revamp the Nusach of the Anshei Knesset Hagdola, which actually means the common statement that we make that the Shmona Esrei was written by the Anshei Knesset Hagdola is not 100% true. They created the structure of the brachos, but there were modifications introduced in the time of Rabban Gamliel. So be it as it may, there were people who wrote, who edited the other brachos, let them write Birchas Aminim. What is so unique about Birchas Aminim? So Rav Kook said that Birchas Aminim is unique because it is the only bracha that asks Hashem to curse. Every other bracha in Shmona Esrei, once you get into Bakashos, after the Shvach, is you ask Hashem, give me Das, help me do Tshuva, forgive my Averis, give me Geula, not give me, give us. That's all the Lashon Rabbim. Give us Geula, give us Parnasa, give us Kibbutz Golios, bless the Tzadikim, be Makabel our Tzfilas. The one bracha that stands out as a negative, destroy, wipe out. Birchas Aminim is a bracha of destruction. And here's the problem. When you come and you ask Hashem to destroy, your motives have to be not because you want somebody to suffer. Your motives have to be that this is good for Am Yisrael, that this is a way of Hashem's name being elevated. If your motive is tainted by hatred, by anger, by resentment, by a desire to see even a Russia suffer, then your prayer is not acceptable by Hashem. So Rabbi Gamliel's dilemma is this. Given the fact that these missionaries, apostates, informers, they have done so much harm to the Jewish people, who is capable of writing a bracha asking God to punish, not because of their desire for revenge, but totally l'shem shamayim? It's an impossible task. Who could write a bracha, you know, calling for Hitler's death without feeling that hatred towards Hitler? So the one that Rav Gamliel found was Shmuel HaKatan. Now, we don't know a lot about Shmuel HaKatan. We know that he was humble, that's why he's called Katan. We know a few stories about Shmuel HaKatan. We know, for example, that he was once in an asifa to be Makadish the Chodesh. And a voice from heaven came out and said, there is someone in this room that is deserving to have the Shekhinah rest on him like Moshe Rabbeinu. And Hashem didn't say who that was, and everybody looked at Shmuel HaKatan. That was the Madriga. We have yet another story that once there was a meeting, apparently, and somebody had eaten some very strong garlic, so the breath was not so pleasant. So Rabbi Gamliel announced, whoever ate the garlic, you know, get out. And Shmuel HaKatan got up and left so that the other person would also leave. So that way, that person wouldn't necessarily be as embarrassed. So Shmuel HaKatan was very, very righteous. But we really have almost no statements by him. But the one statement we have from Shmuel HaKatan is in Pirkei Avos. And it's not even his statement. It's a pasuk in Mishlei, but apparently it's called his statement because he always said it. It says, Shmuel HaKatan Haya Omer B'nefal Ayivecha Al Tismach. When your enemy falls, do not rejoice personally. And apparently, even this is a pasuk, this is not his statement, but apparently he said it all the time. Rabbi Gamliel says, you're the person who should write the Birchas Aminim. So that does tell you that Birchas Aminim is a certain type of intention that is hard to achieve. And that is, those who need to be destroyed need to be destroyed, but there's no joy in it. Again, the Raya is from Mitzrayim. That when the Egyptians were drowning, right, the Chazal say, Rav Yochanan says, that the Malachi Yasharis wanted to say Shira to Hashem, and Hashem said, Maisa Yadai Tavim Bayam, my creatures are drowning in the sea, and how can you say Shira? And what's important to understand is, Hashem didn't say, oh, my creatures are drowning, so I'm going to save them. No, there are times in which Rishus has to be wiped out. But you don't, you know, you don't get joy. You don't dance around, oh, Baruch Hashem, you know, I killed all these Rishayim. Because it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy. It's a tragedy that the Rishayim didn't do tshuva. You know, imagine, again, imagine the feeling of a parent that has a son who committed, who murdered people, committed real, I mean, we have these situations when you have these mass murderers who, you know, they go to jail, they get the capital punishment. And they have parents. Like, what does a parent feel about such a child? Of course, if the parent is normal, the parent, you know, is abhorred about what the child did. But there's still a love in their heart. Hashem is the same way. Much more so. HaKadosh Baruch Hu loves every human being that he created, B'Tzelem Elokim. So when a person is a Rasha, the tragedy of a Rasha is not only the riches he did to other people, but it's the destroying of his own soul, his own godliness. And therefore Hashem mourns, Hashem mourns. The Gemara says when somebody gets executed, it's a mitzvah in the Torah. So you hang a person up, a Jew, you know, you hang a person up, but you must take the body down right away. You don't let it wait until the sun sets even. And the language of the Chumash is, ki kilolas Elokim taloi. A hung up body is a curse or a reproach to the Almighty. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin has a slightly different translation of kilolas. It does not translate it as curse, but it translated it as a heaviness. It says, Hashem says, when I see, Kavyacha, I see a human being who was such a Rasha that he had to be put to death. He says, my head is very heavy, Kavyacha, meaning, I can't even hold my head up. Hashem mourns the rishus that this person did. So, how is it shaykh to have glee and simcha in the death of a Rasha? It's necessary. And you're happy that the Rasha will no longer do what the Rasha does, but it is a tragedy nonetheless.
Yeah. Would that thought also apply to Amalek?
Well, that is a good question. That is a good question. The question is, do we look at Amalek as being made in the image of God? I mean, the simple meaning would be, there would be. I would think even for Amalek it applies that way. Now, granted, it may be Amalek doesn't have a tikkun, but that may make the tragedy even more. See, certain mitzvahs, that's the thing. It's hard to describe it, but the way some Bali Musar describe it, the nature of certain, on one hand we say you should always do mitzvahs for simcha, but certain mitzvahs you don't do for simcha. Certain mitzvahs you do because God commanded you to do them. But they're not meant to be done joyously. Killing a Amalek should not be something that you're dancing. Baruch Hashem, killing a Amalek. You do it because you need to do it, but it's not something that you're simple, because ultimately it's a tragedy. I mean, you know, Hitler was a tragedy. A tragedy, of course, for 6 million people and more than that, but 6 million Jews who died. But there's a tragedy for Adolf Hitler, too. Because Mitzad HaKadosh Baruch Hu, every human being had the potential to be righteous. And when they destroy it, it creates indescribable tsar to the Ribbono Shel Olam.
Connected to that, but the Jewish people did celebrate when Egypt broke.
That's a very good question.
It's an old pasuk in Tehillim that says the righteous shall rejoice when he sees vengeance.
Yeah.
He washes his feet with the blood of Hashem.
Yeah, that is a kasha that people do ask, and that is, number one, the Jewish people said as Yashir when they were extricated from the Yam Suf, and there is a pasuk in Tehillim that says, Be'ibud Risha'im Rina, which means upon the destruction of the evildoers, there is Rina, Rina meaning singing, and that seems to contradict from the following Vachal Tisbach. It is a good kasha. But, well, let me answer each question separately. The Jewish people singing by the Yom Suf is that they are expressing gratitude that they were redeemed, and therefore the Malachim were not directly redeemed, so they can't say that, but the one who is redeemed can express Hakaras HaTov for that alone. And the Ibid Rishon Rina, the Baal HaTanya, says the following. Again, it really is a dichotomy, that on one hand, the death of the evildoers is a source of simcha, because it is a Kiddush Hashem. It shows that God's laws cannot be ignored, that there is going to be a consequence. There is a din v'cheshbon. So I rejoice that the name of God has been glorified by showing that you cannot violate His will with impunity. But I am still saddened that these Rishoyim didn't take that lesson to heart. So there can be a simultaneous sadness and joy at the same time. In fact, Rav Schiller always points out, in a different context, you know, Chazal say that Ruach HaKodesh and Nevuah can only exist when you're besimcha. When you're not besimcha, you can't be a Nabi. So here's our problem. All of the Nevi'im talk about very bad things. Yirmiyahu, Eicha, the Churban Beis HaMikdash. How could he have the Ruach HaKodesh? He was deeply grieving. Somehow, simultaneously with your grieving, there is a simcha over your connection to Hashem. That things can exist at the same time. There can be joy, there can be sadness. The Gemara even says that sometimes you have to make a tova hametiv and dayana emes at the same time. If a person's father died but left them a big inheritance, you make two brachas on the wealth and on the dayana emes, on the loss of a parent. So the notion of simultaneous feelings of joy and grief, they can exist the same. They can exist the same time, and the like. Okay, how did I get on that? I don't even remember. Can you remember? Okay.
Cursing.
Okay, right. Yeah. But this issue, just as a matter of hashkafa, this issue is a deep issue. Whether what do Nevi'im? In other words, I was suggesting that the reason why Bilam could somehow say something that has a negativity is because Bilam ultimately articulated the words in his own words, just getting a message from God, bless, bless, bless. And that would suggest, again, as many Svarim say, that every Navi puts his Nevuah in his own words. And that is the meaning of the phrase that Chazal say, Ein Shnei Nevi'im Misnavnim B'Signon Echad, that two Nevi'im may get the same image, but they will express it differently, because it is filtered through their neshama. It is only Moshe Rabbeinu, where there was no filtering, because Moshe Rabbeinu heard the exact words. So that's going to be very interesting, because then the question becomes, so if we say that Nevi'im are not given direct verbal instructions, and if we say that Nevi'im perceive God through what is called Aspaklaria She'ena Me'ira, so is it possible that a Navi does not even understand his Nevuah? Can a Navi not fully understand the message? Well, Zerach Hashem, Ramchal, says that is possible. But then you get into another question, which the Ramchal seems to say is not possible, and that is, can a Navi... All right, so maybe a Navi does not fully understand the message. Can a Navi get the message wrong? Now, this would get us into extremely deep trouble. Because if we say that the words of a Nevuah are the Navi's own words based on images, and if Chas V'Shalom you were to say you get it wrong, that could mean the whole Nevuah might be false. So apparently, that's not possible. Apparently, if one is Muchzik B'Nevuah, even, so you have to differentiate, it's a subtle distinction between not fully understanding the Nevuah, which is a possibility, and getting the Nevuah wrong, which is not a possibility. And then you get into a subtlety, meaning to say, a Navi might not understand the full repercussions. Let me give you a practical example of this. You know, they say, in the name of the Vilna Gaon, quite an amazing statement, and this is not this is not in any primary source, but this was an oral Messiah in Lithuania, in Lita. It's now in Svara, but it's only because it was an oral tradition that was written down, that they say in the name of the Vilna Gaon that the war of Gog and Magog, which are the final wars before the coming of Mashiach, they are described in the Navi Yecheskel, the Navi Zechariah. The Gra says these wars will last 12 minutes. Now, Rav Yecheskel Avramsky, who was a Talmud, a great, great Gadol who died in like the 1970s, said he heard this growing up, and he dismissed it as a Bava Maisa, because he says, what sense does it make for a war to last 12 minutes? By the time he died in the 1970s, there had already been Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there already was a nuclear arms race. And he said, now he understands, unfortunately, what type of war could last 12 minutes. I mean, do you understand what the Gra is saying? The Gra, in effect, is saying that the war of Gog and Magog, Chas v'Shalom, could be a nuclear war that would only last 12 minutes. Okay? Now, the good news for you, I don't want you to go home and get into a fallout show. You know, when I was growing up, you know, people were scared. There was a time, again, we should always be, you always have to be worried, but when I was growing up, the United States itself was concerned that there might, God forbid, be nuclear war from the Soviet Union. You know, there was an arms race, etc. So they had, in the 1950s and early 60s, they had bomb shelters and civil defense, and they were telling people about be sure to store your water and your food, you know, in these shelters. And they even had drills in which, you know, you go into these air raid shelters with lead doors and everything else and the like. But the good news is the following. The good news is that there's something else the Gra says that's very important. Mashiach can come in two different ways. There's a pasuk in the book of Yeshayahu, Ani Hashem bi'itah achishena, very famous pasuk. Itah, in its proper time, achishena, I will hasten the coming of Mashiach. So the Gemara asks, there's a contradiction. Bi'itah implies there's a designated time that the Geula will come. Achishena implies Hashem can hurry it up. So is it Ita? Is it Achishena? So the Gemara says it all depends. Zachu, if we have Zachus, Achishena, God could bring Mashiach anytime. Tomorrow. Lo Zachu, if we don't have Zachus, there is still an outside date by which Geula will come, whether we deserve it or not, whether we're ready or not. Yeah.
So the Vilna Gaon wasn't a Navi. Like, how did he know what he said?
Yes, well, again, I mean, the Vilna Gaon was not a Navi, that's true. But there are channels of wisdom. Ruach HaKodesh, I mean, there are channels of wisdom that a great person can have.
He didn't like unlock it through chosen the Kabbalah or anything
like that. Well, he probably did, through Kabbalah and the like. In other words, it was probably through his learning of Kabbalah.
How would it come to him, just like the thoughts in his head?
It would be a thought that he would, you know, figure out. I mean, again, he is, we don't even have any written record of this statement, but it would come through his figuring out different calculations. And
he
a lot
it from his Talmud to like
right. So it seems to be an oral tradition. I had heard it orally myself, and then Baruch Hashem, I found it. There's a 3-volume biography of the Vilna Gaon that Rav Chaim Kanevsky gave a haskama on, Rav David Eliach, and I found it in a footnote. I was very excited, but all the footnotes said was the footnote gave an oral tradition. So the footnote itself, it was the first time I saw it writing, but they didn't have any written source for it, per se. So the thing I want to tell you is this. The Vilna Gaon says that the rule of Chavle Mashiach, all of the birth pains of Mashiach, all of the things that are going to happen, Gog and Magog, is only if you have to go through the whole process, because you don't deserve Mashiach, and you're going to have to wait till the official time, so you got to go through all of this. But if we can be zocheh to Mashiach, by Torah and Masim Tovim in Avas Yisrael, and Mashiach will come not through Be'ita, but through Achishena, everything can be short-circuited. Everything can be cut short. All the Chavlei Mashiach can be taken away by virtue of that. Okay, but be it as it may, the reason I'm bringing this in is the following. In Zechariah's Nevuah of Gog and Magog, Zechariah describes a conflagration, a great, great fire, in which he says, people's flesh shall melt on their bones. Again, unfortunately, this describes nuclear stuff. So what I'm saying is the following. It could very well be, based on the Derech Hashem, that when Zechariah has an image of this, Zechariah himself didn't know nuclear bomb or whatever. That's what the Derech Hashem means, that the Navi does not see the full implications of his Nevuah. But you have to be very careful that that doesn't mean he'll get a false message. If he gets a false message, then Bichlal, you have no... then anything a Navi said, God forbid, could be untrue. And the Torah says, after all, if you don't believe what a Navi tells you, and he's Muchzik bin Navi, you're Chayav Misa, right? So you have to be Mekabel. The words of a Navi is true. So it's a little bit complicated between the difference between, I don't have that 100% clear, the difference between not seeing the whole picture, but at the same time getting a true picture. But one example might be that Zechariah. Zechariah sees the image of the flesh melting, but doesn't necessarily know how that's going to happen, or whatever it is. And that's why it is said that Moshe Rabbeinu had greater clarity in the nevuahs that were said to Avram than even Avram Avinu had, because Moshe Rabbeinu was the Aspaklaria Hameira. Okay, seconds here. Okay. Yeah. Pasuk Zion, next Pasuk. Nefesh Seveya Tavus Nofes, the Nefesh Rieva Kalmar Masuk. Masuk. Right? So literally, a soul that is satiated, that is full, will despise even the sweetest honey. You're stuffed. No matter what you give me, I'm not going to take. But a soul that is hungry, even the most bitter, is going to be sweet. And again, the Vilna Gaon, as he would normally interpret, this is a reference to Torah. And Seveya refers to a person who is filled with the pleasures of this world. Right? He just, you know, he just fills himself with taivas, with money, with foods, with all the taivas of Olam Hazeh. So such a person will despise the sweetness of Torah. In other words, there's literally no room for the sweetness of Torah. In fact, there's a Tisus and Ksuvus brings that before a person should praise, that Torah should go into his mouth, he should pray that, I'm sorry, before he prays that Torah should leave his mouth, that he speaks words of Torah, he should pray that great delicacies don't enter his mouth, because when one is too meshuka in the pleasures of this world, a person doesn't have the yearning and desire for Torah. Yeah.
Just on that note, Jerusalem said once, I think it was someone who knew, he told his rabbi he had a nightmare. He asked what the nightmare was. The nightmare was that he dreamed that he was wealthy.
What a nightmare, yeah. Well, you're right. The Nisayan of Osher is even greater than the Nisayan of Oni. That's what it says. Yep. So what this pasuk is telling me is, and again, it's an interesting point, because on one hand, we are told that we're not supposed to be overly ascetic. The Nazir, who deprives himself of wine, is a chote, is a sinner. Because Hashem said, you can drink wine. Who are you to say, I don't want to drink wine? The Talmud Yerushalmi says, a person is going to be called to a din v'cheshvan for every pleasure in this world he could have enjoyed and didn't, because in a sense, he said he doesn't have hakaras hatov to Hashem. He's not grateful that Hashem created all these things. On the other hand, it's also true that as a person is more meshuka, more invested in the physical, their neshama is less sensitive to ruchnis. Just happens. And the reason is very simple. The reason is that physical pleasures are instant gratifications. And ruchnias takes time and effort. You know, I remember when I got my first fax machine, whatever it was, 30 years ago, 20, 25 years ago. So I had to send a fax from Baltimore to China. And it took 45 seconds. And I was going crazy. I was saying, what is taking so long? Why is it taking 45 seconds? That's almost a minute. What's the pshat? You become so impatient. You know, the War of 1812, which is, you know, war between the United States, the new United States and Great Britain. So a treaty was signed in Belgium, but they didn't get news that the fighting should stop for 3 weeks. They continued to fight a war 3 weeks after the peace treaty was signed. It took 3 weeks to get a message from Europe to the United States. People died in a war that was already over. But now you go forward 150 years, and if it takes 45 minutes to send a fax, you go crazy, or I went crazy, so you go crazy. So what's the pshat? We've lost patience. We want instant gratification.
And that's the Gashmias.
That's Gashmias. Gashmias gives you instant gratification. And we want it in Ruchnias too. But in Ruchnias, there is no instant gratification. Gemara is hard work. You got to think. You're not going to get some immediate fix. That's why in some ways, why there's such a popularization of Kabbalah, not real Kabbalah, but Ersatz Kabbalah, because people think it'll be some instant way that'll get me to a high place. Same thing as drugs. Or that's why people look for segulas. I think I mentioned again. People want quick fixes. Red strings, holy water, some objective thing, like if I do this thing, you know, 10 times, some miracle will happen.
Agav, the red strings, what is it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to disparage any segulas. It's brought down in some sources, but they took the string around Kever Rachel or around and it absorbs something. But as I say, these are quick fixes. They're not the derech. They're not the derech that brings a person. You know, the Brisker Rav was not a big fan of Hasidus, but the Brisker Rav loved one particular Hasidus Rebbe. We didn't even have a lot of Hasidim. So somebody asked the Brisker, why do you like this Rebbe? He doesn't even have a lot of Hasidim. He said, well, I'll tell you. Somebody asked the Rebbe, I need a shidduch. Give me a segula for a shidduch. So the Rebbe says, learn Maseches Kedushin Be'iyun. He says, my business is not going well. He says, learn Baba Metzia with the Shita Mekubetzis. So, this Rebbe wasn't very popular. He didn't have a lot of chassidim. I'm going to go to somebody to give me a red string or something. Learn Baba Metzia with the Shita Mekubetzis. I don't need a Rebbe. I don't need a chassidim Rebbe to tell me that. You know. So, but the Brisker Rav, that was the one Rebbe the Brisker Rav liked a lot. He said, but that's the idea. So when you become habituated to the instant gratification of the physical, then the slow, gradual spiritual work just becomes unappealing because you don't get something right away. Rabbi Saul Solander used to say, everybody would like to know Shas. And Bezras Hashem, that's an attainable goal. Everybody can make a goal that they want to know Shas. But people want to know Shas in 8 hours, one night. That's pretty hard. Maybe the Vilna Gaon could learn Shas in one night. Then he said, people want to learn Shas in one night and get 8 hours of sleep the same night. He says, that I'm not even sure the Vilna Gaon could carry out. But that's what we want. We want to know everything. I want to know the Torah. But we don't want to work, or we're not. You know, it's just hard for us. So, that's really the result of when you're too involved in the physical. You're used to the instant gratification, and then you bring it over into the spiritual world, which is a different world. That's a world of avoda, a world of amelus, a world in which the joys are very, very, very deep, but they come after working and struggling. Then Hashem gives you light and enlightens you, but only coming after that great, great avoda. I mean, the Chazon Ish describes, again, I can't say I have experienced these madrigas yet, but the Chazon Ish describes, you know, that it takes at least, you know, 3 hours of learning till you really feel the sweetness. But then he goes on. He talks about what happens after 8 hours straight, what happens after 10 hours straight, what happens after 12 hours straight. And he describes unbelievable levels of ecstasy that one gets after like the 10 hours or the 12 hours of uninterrupted. That's something that we very, very, very rarely, if ever, experience. But that's there. That comes after the amelus. Right? So the pasuk is saying, he who is satisfied with the physical pleasures of the world will reject the sweetness of the Torah, because the sweetness of the Torah takes time and effort, and you become habituated. In fact, Lahavdil, even in a superficial secular level, this is very true. You know, people who are, let's say, in fact, educators are concerned about the effect of the internet. This is a secular, I'm talking about a secular phenomenon. I'm not talking about, this is not even a Jewish point. It's a human point. That the internet kind of inculcates, you know, web surfing. And I'm not talking about pornography, and I'm not talking about solitaire. I'm talking about, you know, kosher uses of the internet where you're just using it for research. But the nature of web surfing is you jump from thing to thing to thing to thing to get some instant answer to something. And in many colleges, there's actually concern that it's destroying the ability of people to concentrate and to engage in sustained discussion about a point in depth. And therefore, a person that's used to a web surfing mentality will not be able to take the time to really work out something in a deep way. So as a result, although since, you know, the 1990s or so, colleges have required that all incoming students have an internet connection or a laptop, there are some colleges, there's still a major demutu, but there are actually some colleges that are prohibiting laptops in the classroom because they're saying that we want you to concentrate and engage in a deep way. And in fact, I will tell you, in modern Orthodox high schools in the United States, yeshiva high schools, where, you know, the kids are all socially connected with smartphones and everything else, the Gemara Rebbes are going crazy. They say, we cannot learn Gemara with them. They cannot stay on anything more than 10 seconds. And in Gemara, that's going to be fatal. So, therefore, that's what he's saying. He who is satisfied with the physical will reject the sweetness of Torah. And on the other hand, when your soul is hungry, meaning to say you're not shakua in the Olam HaGashmi, then the mar, even the bitterness of Torah, meaning the work, the effort, the sweat, the tears, becomes sweet to you. Because you know that it's leading you to closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Kol mar masuk. And again, well, you know, as I say, Torah does require amelus, and it's not always going to be instant gratification. Now, admittedly, just like, for example, Lahavdil, if a person needs to eat a certain diet that's very unappetizing to him, so sometimes you might add a candy or something, you know, one little thing, so he'll enjoy it and then he'll eat everything else. So it is true that in Torah we do need the equivalent of a candy as well. And that is, this is what Chazal say, that a person should also learn Masha Libo Chafet, what his heart desires to learn, things that especially interest you. We need that motivation. And that motivation has a role. But at the same time, one has to know that knowing Torah requires amelus, and ultimately, however, the amelus itself should be sweet. The mar will become masuk. And then we'll do one more pasuk. Pasuk ches says, Tzibor Nodedes Min Kina Kain Ish Noded Min Kamo. So the simple meaning, this seems to be an almost a non-contextual pasuk. It says, like a bird that wanders from her nest, so is the feeling of a man who wanders away from home. And it is making the point that when a bird leaves the nest, right, the bird itself has a sense of, I want to go home, as I want to go back to my little birds, I want to go back to my eggs, etc. And if there's shiluach hakan, and the bird is banished from the nest, there's a great feeling of estrangement, there's a feeling of loneliness, there's a feeling of desperation. So Shlomo HaMelech is comparing the bird that is wandering from the nest, either because it's looking for food and desperately wants to go back, or it's been sent away. That is the feeling of a man that is in dullness. Now, the Zohar HaKadosh uses this pasuk in a very interesting way. The Zohar HaKadosh says, there's no machlokas about Shiluach HaKen. Shiluach HaKen is a mitzvah in the Torah. It's a mitzvah for which you get Arichas Yomim. You know, there's a bird, right? You send away the bird to take the egg. But the big question is, how do you understand the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKen? Maybe it's simple enough, if I want the eggs, so I gotta send away the mother. But is there any points? Let's say I don't want the, right, I walk by a bird's nest. I don't want to do it. Is there any reason to do it? Meaning to say, do I have to send away the mother and take the eggs, and then I can put them back, that's for sure. Or like, this is only a mitzvah if you want the eggs. It's not a mitzvah if you don't want the eggs. So the pashtus, the simple rationalistic interpretation is, this is not a mitzvah that you seek to do. If you want the eggs, the Torah says you're not allowed to take the mother. But if I don't want the eggs, I don't want them. And yet you find among many, many gedolim and tzaddikim that they do not view it that way, that they will go out of their way to look for a bird's nest to fulfill the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKen. Now, why is that so? On some level, you would think that's almost cruel to the bird. Why are you shooing away the mother from the nest? So the Zohar gives an explanation which is not so easy to understand. The Zohar says that, in fact, when the bird experiences, now, of course, when the bird experiences the pain of being separated, that is ma'orer rachamim in shamayim, on the Jewish people that are separated from Hashem in the Beis HaMikdash. And therefore, Shiluach HaKen is a mechanism to be ma'orer divine mercy, based on this pasuk, as a bird wanders from the nest, so too is the feeling of a man that is wandering, in other words, the Jewish people in Galus, and also Ish is Hashem. Hashem is called Ish Milchama, and therefore it somehow exemplifies the tsar of the Shekhinah, and it brings Gula. Now we're not sure exactly how this works, but Shiluach HaKen is a microcosm of the Golus of the Jewish people, and the Golus HaShekhinah, and therefore it's Ma'orah Rachamim, and that is why Alpi Kabbalah, one should seek the opportunity of Shiluach HaKen, although Alpi Halacha, if you don't want the egg, you're not Mechuyev, to seek that opportunity. Now the Vilna Gaon offers another interpretation, though. Yeah?
How does that connect to the reward for that mitzvah?
Well, the Torah says, Arichas Yomim. Yeah, well, the idea, once again, is that especially if you're learning that you are concerned with the glory of God, the pain of Hashem, so it's Mida Keneged Mida, if you're concerned with Hashem's Tsar, He will be concerned with your needs and give you a longer life. Now, the other interpretation is this, that this is referring to a person's attitude. What is a person's home? It says, as a bird wanders from her nest, so too is a man's feeling when he wanders from his home. A person's home should be a Beis HaMedrash. Torah should be your home. So how do you feel when you have to leave your home? You have to go to work? You have to leave yeshiva? your feeling should be exactly like a bird that leaves the nest. When a bird leaves its nest, the bird yearns and hopes that it will be able to return. And to whatever degree birds have cognition, again, it's as if the bird is waiting for the chance to come back. So too, when the person is separated from Torah learning, he should feel like a bird that has left the nest for a while, but you're going to come back. So it's a certain attitude. In fact, this is reflected in halacha. The halacha is, we make Birchas HaTorah in the morning. And that covers me the whole day. Again, if I sleep during the day, that's a machlokas. Mr. Burr actually says, if you make a new Birchas HaTorah after you slept for a half an hour, lo hifsid, you're allowed to do it. Others say you don't do it. But it is pashut that even if I go to work, and I do all sorts of other activities, if I didn't sleep, I do not make Birchas HaTorah again. That's for sure. No opinion in halacha says I make Birchas HaTorah because I worked for a few hours or I worked for 8 hours. Right? So Taisus explains, Taisus Zichus Brachus says, even though normally there's Hesach Hadas. I mean, normally, if I make a bracha on an apple, then I go to other activities and I'm not thinking about eating the apple. When I eat another apple later, I make a new bracha. So why don't I make a new Birchas HaTorah? So Tosva says, because in Limud HaTorah, you're never supposed to be Mesiach Das. So even if there'll be many hours you're not going to be learning, your mind always has to be, I'm going to get back to it when I can. And that is why I don't make a new Birchas HaTorah. Now if you're going to tell me, well, yeah, but what if that's not who I am? What if, you know, I finish for the day? And then I learn later as a surprise to me. I didn't even expect it. So I was Mesiach Das Lagamri. So you have to understand that the way these halachas work, sometimes Chazal creates a system based on the ideal of what you should be, even if that's not who you are. Chazal say, we are enacting the dinim of Birkas HaTorah based on the idea that a person is not Mesiach Das. Ah, you say you were Mesiach Das? Well, you weren't a person. That's not what a person does. A person is not Mesiach Das. Right? So these are pedagogical points, meaning the very structure of it teaches us how we're supposed to feel. We are like a bird that has left the nest to get food, parnasa, but then we gotta go back. That's our home. This is where we live. It doesn't have to be a particular yeshiva, but it means the Olam Shel Torah, the Olam Shel Torah is where a person lives. It's similar, this reminds me of a vort of the Meshech Chochma. The Meshech Chochma points out that the bracha on food, to Oraisa, is benching after you eat. The bracha before food is only midrabanan. And yet the Ramban says the bracha before Torah learning is a Doraisa. That's the Ramban sheet, a bracha before Torah learning. So how come for food, the Iker bracha Doraisa is what you do after you eat, and for Torah learning, the Iker bracha you do is before you learn? So he says, what is a bracha? A bracha is Hakaras HaTov to Hashem, for the gift that Hashem gave me. So when it comes to food, initially, you didn't have to make a bracha before you eat, because when a person is hungry, they're instinctively grateful. So when there's instinctive gratitude, Baruch Hashem, and I have the water, Baruch Hashem. So when there's instinctive gratitude, you didn't have to make a bracha. But after you eat, although logically you ought to be grateful, more grateful, but Kochi V'Otzim Yadi, I don't need Hashem anymore, I'm full. So after you eat, Hashem says, be sure to say thank you. Think about it. Of course, you read Asadoros, apparently we became so ungrateful that even before we eat, we're not grateful, so we have to make a bracha. But the original idea was, instinctual hakaras hatayiv is before, but the arrogance of not needing Hashem comes after, that's why you make a bracha. With Torah, Reb Meir Simcha says, it's the opposite. Before you sit down and learn, a person sometimes doesn't want to learn. A person says, oh, Torah is, I'd rather read the paper, I'd rather sleep, I'd rather, you know, play basketball. So you gotta make a bracha to know how wonderful the gift is. But Zakra Meir Simcha, after you learn, you don't need a bracha. Of course you'll be grateful. Once you learn Torah, of course you'll know it's the most wonderful thing in the world. You don't need a bracha on Torah after you eat. The Hakaras HaTorah is mimela. So then, this is what I'm saying, so then you'll say, well, what about me? I don't feel so great after I learn. Good. The answer is that the halachic structure was created to reflect how I should feel, even if I'm not quite there, because it tells me what I should be. Right? In other words, halacha is not always a mirror of an existing reality. It is sometimes there to teach me a model of what the ideal reality should be. The ideal reality should be that when I learn, the Hakaras HaTorah is so great that it doesn't even, the Meshech Chachma says, it doesn't even have to be expressed as a bracha. Okay, maybe we'll stop here. Have a good week.